Hello and welcome to Ops and Hops, the podcast for those who like beer but have to work in tech to afford it. Today I've got Matt Gowie, CTO of Masterpoint Consulting, who specializes in AWS, Terraform, and containerized environments for a myriad of clients. So this should be right up my alley, and I have a feeling we're going to have a lot to talk about. Matt, welcome to the show, and what are you drinking, and why did you choose it?
Yeah, thanks for having me. Drinking my local Left Hand. They're right up in Longmont. I'm in Boulder, Colorado. So Left Hand milk stouts, and out of a nice Lander bar in Wyoming, glass. So yeah, this was leftover from Thanksgiving, and I haven't been drinking kind of since then, just because I had family in town, drank probably a little bit too much with them, and I've been trying to chill out for a little bit. So it's been good.
Yeah, no, my phase is coming up as I travel down to the South this coming week. So I imagine there will be plenty of bourbon coming along with the Christmas spirit.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I'm actually grabbing something from Minneapolis, the Abrasive Double IPA. Just seemed like something to get me through the holidays. Pretty nice little double IPA here, and I've actually got it in a Jagged Mountain Craft Brewery glass, which is on 20th in Denver, so not too far from you. Yeah, pretty solid little place.
It's funny. I was just going to say, I've never heard of them before. And of course, you know, they're in Denver, right down the road from me, but there's so many damn breweries in Colorado that the fact that I've never heard of them is totally normal. So that's the way it goes here.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I strongly suggest them. They're really awesome. I don't know that I've ever seen their beer actually go any further than maybe like the bar next door. So
yeah.
It's super solid, you know, pretty wide thing. And usually about once a year, they'll do an anniversary special. Like I know they did a quintuple one year, which was pretty much you do one and then you just go home and take a nap. That's pretty much
yeah,
how
that
it
sounds
went,
right.
But
yeah. I like triples. I don't know about a quintuple. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a lot. It was definitely a lot. So we were talking a little bit earlier before we hit the record button, you know, and on this show, you know, with me and my Terraform background and all, we talked a lot about the business license with HashiCorp, all these big changes and how it's affected Terraform so far. But I think we both noticed that it looks like Vault is in the crosshairs now.
Yeah.
Which is huge because that actually is HashiCorp's real moneymaker. So
that's
what have you seen with that?
It. Yeah. I think I was just reading a thread today about the Hacker News comments on, you know, OpenBow, which is the Vault fork. And it was really interesting comments. Like I just queued up a LinkedIn post about it because they're fascinating and, you know, you should go and read that Hacker News thread. But basically, you know, there's people that are, you know, unconfirmed, you know, who knows if this is actually true. They were specifically a throwaway account, but they were saying that, hey, they were either a HashCorp employee or a former HashCorp employee and were, you know, mentioning that the fork or the BSL license change wasn't about Terraform, but it was more about Vault and about, you know, IBM, who was supposedly behind the Vault fork, the OpenBow project, that they are the, you know, reason that HashiCorp forked. And again, unconfirmed, but like that's pretty fascinating because, hey, if IBM is reselling HashiCorp's Vault product, and again, what you're saying like is totally true. Vault has always been Hashi's moneymaker because they charge a ton for that enterprise license. And I could see them doing it in that fashion, you know, like if that was one of their main reasons. Of course, as soon as the current HashCorp employee said, hey, the reason we actually did the BSL change was because of Vault and IBM, somebody who used to work at HashiCorp commented and was like, hey, I know that that's not what I heard, you know? So right. It's an interesting thread, interesting times we live in terms of all these license changes. Because it feels like it's causing others to change their license. It's, you know, a bunch of stuff is coming up out of it. And it's creating a lot of really interesting conversations around what is open source and like what people think is fair. And that's where I get fascinated. I get like, it's so interesting to see the different views and kind of the polarity between like, oh, it's totally fine. They're allowed to do whatever they want. It's their project versus the people. Kind of like my thought process is like, where's my pitchfork? And I get upset about it. But yeah, it's a interesting times.
Yeah, I was a little more on the fence with the previous big like BSL type changes, you know, and Elastic and Mongo, not as much Mongo, I think more like Elastic. I was kind of like, you know, they've got a front end for this thing. They've got all of this kind of stuff. It's a more just wrappable product that's based on technology that they did build. Terraform, in my opinion, is a little more like, well, it's actually only good because of the providers, and the providers are related to other companies. And that's always been something that kind of made me feel a little more iffy about it. But in that same vein with Vault, Vault's a little bit different than that. So, you know, Vault is kind of a self-contained product. I haven't used it a whole lot. I do use it, but it's a little more of a self-contained product. So I could actually see how they might be able to protect Vault, or at least feels a little bit better to me if they had done it to Vault, but maybe not Terraform. But of course, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think the value in Terraform is those providers. It's the ecosystem, the community that got created around that. Hey, we all need to talk to these different APIs. Like, how are we going to do that? These providers got spun up because Terraform was like the first in the market to be smart about that, build the correct plugin model. And they created a ton of value. They created a ton of community because of it. But yeah, the same thing isn't true of Vault. Like there are plugins in Vault, but I don't think they're anywhere near as important as like the provider ecosystem is. So right. Yeah, I could see it. I could see my, you know, thought process being really different if they had only done the BSL change for Vault, because it would be much more similar to Elasticsearch, you know, and OpenSearch and that whole debacle. But it feels very different for Terraform. But maybe that's because I'm actually in the Terraform community and very involved in that world. And maybe yeah. I would be, you know, grabbing my pitchfork for Vault if it was just Vault anyway. So I don't know.
Yeah, I think I would still be mad about it. It would still bug me just seeing it go that route. I would still go to bat, you know, for the others. But at the end of the day, if you told me I had to pick one, you know, that I was really passionately against, it would be Terraform, I think, because of that provider ecosystem.
And, you know, it's the providers, but also, you know, people keep rehashing the same thought process. You know, I've seen the quote like multiple times, and it's like, hey, if you're not running a Terraform cloud competitor, then it doesn't affect you. And thank you for the eye roll, because I'm just like, please, just stop. That's not the case. It does affect you because you don't have options. When you're janky, you know, when your scripts that run Terraform, you know, stop being good enough and you want to stop investing engineering hours into them and you want to actually have a proper product that automates your Terraform, because Terraform is not going away and it's like a really good tool. If your only choice is the really expensive resource-based Terraform cloud offerings, then you're kind of screwed. Like, you don't have the option to go to other products, and then that sucks. That just sucks. I don't know. I get frustrated by that idea. I think that, you know, there's great competitors in the space. They should be allowed to compete. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, it's bolted in. It's not like these competitors are building Terraform. They're just deploying Terraform. It's like deploying any other product. I don't like how the fact that they were unable to monetize it to their investor satisfaction is what caused everybody to get punished.
Yeah.
But so what have you seen as far as it? I guess you might have to tiptoe around that. Let me see if I can rephrase that to something to make sure it's not something that might ask you to jump in the hot water. But One of the things like I've always kind of wondered about is, you know, how difficult it is to deal with the HashiCorp lawyers, because the BSL license, I know it's like ATM machine, the BSL license is so cryptic in the way that they've done it. And so here's a theory that I've thrown out to some people, and nobody's really had an answer yet. Maybe you've got a thought. If you've got a like enterprise company with two business units, you know, and a lot of times these larger companies are selling things back and forth. They've got to exchange money. I mean, even if it's on paper and it all flows up to the same place, it's still exchanging money in one way or another, whether it's using resources from another business unit or whatever. So if one of these business units develops a GitHub action script that deploys Terraform,
yeah,
is the water starting to boil, or, you know, are the lawyers just going to be like, nah, it's cool, build whatever you want, we don't care. You know, where is this written, or is it written anywhere?
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's so ambiguous within the documentation. And it was really confusing, particularly when that license first came out. It was, there was no frequently asked questions, or if there was, they were so limited and they weren't, you know, clear at all. And there's certain stuff in there that's like scary. Like,
yeah.
And yeah, I get your point. Yeah, I think that the way that they wrote it seems to be, they can enforce it if you're creating a system like what you're talking about, like you're selling to a sister company, a means by which to run production Terraform, even if it's just a simple GitHub action pipeline. And, you know, it's not even anything, a big deal. They could come after you. Now, are they going to? Probably not. But, you know, there's companies that don't want to deal with that at all. Like they just like don't even want that anywhere near their radar. And I respect them for that. You know, you shouldn't have to concern yourself with that idea. And that's one of the sad things about the whole license change, is that it's just this, you know, I think it's a slap to the community, but it's also like, if I was an enterprise client, I actually wouldn't want to pick up, you know, a BSL licensed tool, because it would scare me from the perspective that like, hey, is this going to be something that has legs that we can invest into and like feel like we're not going to be shoehorned and, you know, stuck on one like place for support. You know, there was definitely a big thing within consulting companies. Like I know that, when I read the license change, I was worried that we would be potentially like liable. And, you know, I have a team of six, you know, we are, and most of my fellow consulting, you know, firm founders that look like Masterpoint, they are also really small in size. And it's like, hey, if we're, I don't know, like there's some really, it was so ambiguous that it was one of those things where like, hey, if we were potentially liable here and they could come after us, that's super sketchy. And I don't think that's actually the case. Again, I don't think they're going to do that, but they've got a lot of options in doing whatever they want with the way they wrote things. And that's the sketchy part. So
I don't know. That was my next question, actually. Yeah, that was actually my next question, was what about on the smaller side? You know, what happens with you? What happens if you decide to write something that is being used and you're like, wow, you know, this would really make our lives easier if we could just sell this platform to companies that are not going to pay for Terraform Cloud, period.
Yeah.
You know, it's, but I also, it's like, what if you were looking to sell or take investment or something like that? They're going to do these massive, massive audits. They're coming in with, you know, the steam shovel. They're going deep. They're going down and they're going to start looking for things. When they start seeing an ambiguous license, that could scare somebody off.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And looking at selling or taking on investment, I mean, is like a really good point. Like as soon as due diligence gets involved in that sort of thing, it's sketchy. But yeah, I mean, we wouldn't want to create a product that was on Terraform nowadays, just because it's so ambiguous. And obviously that's like not a smart move. I would be afraid and not be interested in investing in that tool set. And the folks, everybody that, you know, does, from the smaller shops like Terra Team, the folks at Terramate, to bigger folks like Scalar and M0 and Spacelift, like all of them backed OpenTofu, because it's like, it just makes sense, of course, but it's also it's one of those things that they were backed into a corner, and I, you know, I feel for them. I don't know. We'll be switching certain projects, certain clients over to Open Tofu in the new year. That's one of my like big goals. Okay. And we'll have a blog post about it. And I think it should be interesting to see what we run into, if anything. And it'll be interesting to see the continuation of that like project and that community. I think we've advised clients to not make the switch yet. For our bigger clients, but for small clients that we feel like, hey, we can, you know, if this ends up being a bad call, we can swap it out and do it at no cost to the client. We're going to do it for one of them at least. And I'm excited to try it out because it just makes it so that we can avoid some of this ambiguity and, you know, the sketchiness of the whole thing.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I have one of the maintainers on the Open Tofu maintainers on here very recently. And he said, drop in replacement up to 1.6, you know, if you want to alias Open Tofu to Terraform, you know, call that's it a day, like, you can do that and that's it. So
cool.
In that case, you know, what's the loss in just removing that risk?
I'm going to go out and check out that podcast. Because that sounds like a good one.
Yeah. It's not one published yet. Not yet. It will be soon. Okay. It will be soon.
Gotcha.
So on that, I mean, as far as the future of Terraform, obviously things are getting super, super complicated now. What do you think is next? I know there's a lot of stuff out there. Obviously, Open Tofu could take the mantle and just continue. I know CloudFormation. Sorry, I'm laughing. I try with them. CloudFormation's gotten me out of several jams, you know, when I need to do something quick or deploy a quick Lambda. But, or honestly, I use CloudFormation to deploy S3 buckets, DynamoDB tables for Terraform backends when I'm not using somebody else. And I use it for my IAM roles and things that I need to get things kicked off. That's really what CloudFormation is for, is to make Terraform work. But
I've got Terraform for you that can help make Terraform work. If you want. I'll share.
But then I need a state for the state for the state, you know?
You do.
States all the way down.
It is states all the way down. I'd rather have states instead of stacks.
Yeah, makes sense.
But then again, stacks is now an overloaded word.
I love that they finally just released CloudFormation CI/CD, basically. You can finally upload CloudFormation to GitHub and have it take off.
Okay,
monitor
cool.
A repository. I'm blown away that it's taken this long, but I did see that release the other day. I haven't played with it yet, but at least I think they're making a move. But aside from them, which you have aired your grievances on, how do you feel about the other big players? What about like Upbound's Crossplane?
Yeah. I was really excited about Crossplane. So about a year ago, I had hired, I guess it was my first or second full-time person, but I hired Veronica on my team. She wrote a blog post for us on Crossplane. We investigated Crossplane for a long time. You know, I'm talking a month, 2 months. Like we put a lot of diligence into it. Because I was personally excited about it. I really love the GitOps model. Kubernetes, for all its faults, has some great tooling that you can bring along and, you know, hey, you've got all your friends together and everything can kind of come together nicely. And we really went deep on an investigation in Crossplane. And then we just realized like, hey, we wouldn't be able to give this to a customer and feel good about it. Just from the perspective that, hey, it's hard to debug. It's, you know, there's a lot of missing functionality. Simple things that we, you know, love from Terraform aren't really there. You can run Terraform through Crossplane, but then you get the worst of both worlds. And that feels wrong. There's a bunch of things about Crossplane that we ended up not being, you know, I ended up having to reverse my own excitedness about. And, you know, again, blog post that kind of covers that. I still think that that idea of a GitOps first approach to infrastructure as code is great. You still do need apply, like manual apply workflows. And that's like one of the pieces that I think, you know, Terraform still does the best out of everybody, and everybody else that's copied Terraform, they're doing it the same way. So yeah, I don't know. Crossplane is not going to be a part of our tool set. I think it works for really big Kubernetes focused platform teams. Like if you have a platform team that is in, you know, completely focused on Kubernetes for a large organization, Crossplane could work. But we were not, we worked with a bunch of startups. We worked with mid-market. We worked with enterprise. We were not going to introduce that for our customers. To continue on that conversation of like, hey, what other IaaS tools are out there? I think it's this still this war of imperative versus declarative. And I'm like strongly in the declarative camp, and I think I will stay there. You know, my whole thing that I, you know, have railed about is complexity. Declarative decreases complexity, and it makes it so that you can't shoot yourself in the foot, and you can't have an engineer who's just making a random HTTP request in the middle of your pipeline.
Don't worry. They do have a Terraform HTTP provider. So.
Well, that's true. That's true.
You can figure it out.
Yeah, you can do a lot with Terraform if you go off road off of like the standard providers. I feel like you can include environment variables. You can make HTTP requests. You can do the old null resource to shell and make everybody hate their life.
I have to do it in my course just because like it's in the exam. You do have to cover it, and there are times for very simple local workflows that it makes sense, but. Otherwise, I have done the Jenkins calling Terraform and then executing Ansible based on Terraform outputs type workflows, which is nice when you've got to do something when Ansible has to exist. But if I can avoid it, I will avoid it at all costs nowadays.
Yeah. And I think that's what we do. We try and avoid Ansible nowadays, at least, you know, for all the work that we do. But it still comes up. You know, we have clients who are on EC2s and Ansible makes sense sometimes. Can't treat them all like cattle. I think that what I'm interested in for infrastructure as code is one thing from this BSL change, it's going to shake things up, right? Like, and it already has. And I think that it's going to make people rethink like, oh, maybe I won't use Terraform. Maybe I should build my own thing. And then maybe we'll get the new generation of infrastructure as code tools a year from now that are, there's so many learnings that we could take from the failures of Terraform that if we were to build a new tool today, I think we could build something really freaking cool. I'm not going to go and do it. I'm not like going to go sling Golang for, you know, 80 hours a week to build the best open source project. But I'm excited for somebody who is. And I think that the next iteration of infrastructure as code tools are going to be exciting. So
have you played with Solomon Hayek's Dagger yet?
I haven't. I've looked a little into it, but I have not like dug all the way in. Do you think it's in that space?
Ish. It seems, I think what I'm seeing now is, God, you know what? I forgot to look up this stupid thing on the last podcast when I was talking about this. And so it's not infrastructure as code. It's, oh man, I'm trying
pipelines as code?
No, it's not exactly pipelines. It's more a lot of what's happening now that I'm seeing is you're not just abstracting the infrastructure. Or I'm sorry, you are abstracting the infrastructure. You're going way further into it though, in that you say, hey, look, I need a function written in JavaScript. Just write that JavaScript function. And it says, okay, we're going to create a Lambda. We're going to create a queue. We're going to create everything you need within infrastructure, like infrastructure wise, everything you need just by declaring that function.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm starting to see that a lot more. And I wish I
infrastructure
could remember
from code.
From.
Is that the
you,
idea?
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah.
That's it.
I have heard of that. I think that is definitely interesting. That could be great. I think it ends up coming down to where does the where does the buck stop with that? Like, can you actually build a very viable product when that stuff can get really complicated quick? Like, how does it all intermingle? Like, would it know to use the same API gateway if I'm building 50 functions? Does it know to create new API keys for those API gateways? Like, there's some interesting stuff there. I haven't played with those tools, but I should. It's interesting that you're bringing it up. But it's a cool avenue that people are going down.
Yeah, it seems like, you know, Vercel and a lot of other companies are definitely diving into it very heavily, and they're just further abstracting things on top of other things. And the abstraction gets further, and I think there's probably going to be a massive pain point, you know, in the middle as we build it out and we keep trying to cram legacy stuff into newer stuff, and you're going to end up finding all of these like hybrid deployment problems. Yeah. But I imagine that a lot of greenfield stuff is probably doing pretty well up until it didn't, you know, I mean, probably some sort of crazy scale where you can probably hire enough people to fix whatever you break by the time you get to that point. At least that's what I'm hearing. But of course, we'll see what AI does. AI might make all of this moot, and it won't even matter. Yeah.
It could be that, hey, we create that system diagram. You hire one senior level architect, and there was some product that would create you took your diagram that you created in their system, and then it would spit out Terraform code for you.
Yeah, it's Brainboard.
Yeah. Cool idea. I've never used it because I know it was going to spit out a bunch of like resources and kind of unmaintainable Terraform code that I really wouldn't want. I think that there's like that potential future of like, you know, however many years from now it is, where, hey, architect kind of like designs the thing and then there it is. There's your infrastructure as code. That's what you're maintaining long-term. It's fascinating. And it's like kind of what a system initiative is doing, or, you know, Mass Driver. There's so many people in the space now. We've basically rethought how we manage infrastructure, and it's kind of gotten everybody's, the light bulb moment went off that, hey, this ops thing is kind of difficult and we need to have better tooling around it. It's cool.
That's why we have our ops.
Yeah. Need them to get through. But then maybe AI will take over and we won't need them as much.
I mean, I use it all the time. I do have to fix it all the time, but I do use it all the time. So, I mean, speaking of course, making things easier for developers, obviously platform engineering is the new hotness. I've gotten into some pretty publicized arguments over whether DevOps is platform engineering, or whether, you know, this is a progression, or whether, in my opinion, DevOps is a part of, or sorry, platform engineering uses DevOps concepts. Has always been my theory.
Yeah. I think that, you know, the only thing I've gotten on platform engineering as a term, really like it as a term. And I think so much comes down to like, hey, how are we describing what we're doing? The only problem with DevOps is that like it's been so co-opted to be 50,000 things and nobody knows what it means. Everybody has their own definition that that's what's difficult about it. And I feel like platform engineering, it's like, hey, you have engineers who are building the platform that your software runs on.
Yep.
The platform is the key critical name there. That makes sense. It makes sense to me. It makes sense to like other people, I think. And that's why I'm a big fan of it, instead of like, well, DevOps is a culture. No, DevOps is a job title. No, you're doing ops, but you're also developing application code. And I think that like, you can take somebody out there, you'll pick out 10 engineers, they'll all have their own answer, and it's a mess. And platform engineering hopefully brings a little bit more clarity there. We'll see. It'll probably get co-opted too, to be 50 different things. And then
I like that. Like that, you know, platform engineering gives you kind of a outcome and says, hey, this is it. No matter who you ask, this is an actual thing, whether it uses what you call DevOps principles or whatever. So would you say maybe just say platform engineering uses agile principles or something like that and just kick DevOps to the curb, or What would you think?
I think that I wouldn't say that. I think kicking DevOps to the curb, we've been doing that. I've been trying to do that. I don't think it's, you don't need to kick DevOps to the curb as a term. If you have like a strong definition of it at your organization or your, for yourself or your team, I wouldn't say that like platform engineering is like agile or anything like that. I think the only thing that I like that people are focused around platform engineering is that, hey, we're treating the platform as a product. We're focusing on developer experience. Our engineers, our application engineers, they're the people that we're serving. We're building for them to make it their lives easier. And that's the goal. That's always been my goal ever since I started to focus more on, like, I used to be an application engineer and I wrote lots of, you know, TypeScript and all the things, Ruby. And I transitioned more towards Terraform and more towards, you know, all my AWS background. When I did that, it was really, I loved having engineers, application engineers as my users. Making them happy is awesome. That's what platform engineering is to me. Like, it is a means by which to think about, hey, those application engineers are our users. We're trying to serve them. We should ask them questions. We should make sure that they're happy with the thing that we're delivering. Our platform is the product to them. And then that is hopefully the, I don't know, if that's the minimum thing we take away from it, that's great. That's great. That's what I hope. Yeah.
No, that sounds great.
It doesn't need to be an IDP. I'll say that.
Okay. I will say that if anybody is looking for Ruby engineers, Colorado has this uncanny concentration of them, thanks to a few very popular boot camps in the area.
Yeah.
Not saying you went to that boot camp, but after living in Denver, I think I know hundreds of Ruby developers at this point. Probably through that developer happy hour that they have every month. It's wild.
Yeah, we've got a good number of them. I did not go there. I'm not originally from Denver or this area. Yeah. But the who is it? There's a G boot camp and there's a T boot camp, and I'm blanking on both of them. Not Gravitron.
Flatiron is the big one.
Oh, Flatiron is definitely one of them. Yeah.
Or at least it's the big one that I always knew about. Everybody I know that, pretty much anybody I know that's learned Ruby in the past, I don't know, 5 years, probably learned it from Flatiron. Yeah. Almost.
You know what's interesting? As a total aside, we don't even need to go down this path, but I will say that we've seen Ruby like go out of style in the past, like, 5-10 years. Like it Rails like kind of like, you know, had its tapering and it's like going slower down the programming list, but like Rails and Ruby are great languages. Like, or, you know, Rails is a great framework. You can do a lot.
A comeback.
I think that they are. Yeah. It seems like people are excited about new things.
I don't know if it's a lot of a comeback, but there is a steadfast group of people that will not let it go. And I mean, honestly, for not really bad reason. It's hanging on. I mean, you know, Python has gone so far down the data path that although there are some good API things with Python, you know, Django and all of that are fine, I just, based on the number of people who I know who use Rails, I don't know that I would trust starting Django Greenfield versus maybe Rails. If you want something, you know, batteries included,
I'd rather go with either of those choices than go and build an Express app and be like, hey, I'm doing microservices for my startup. It's going to be great. You know, I'd much rather build the monolith that I need to break down into microservices or break up than go down the microservices path. Because
by
I think
the time that, you need those, you can afford the people to do it is exactly. Kind of the way I think of it is.
Yeah.
And, you know, microservices, at least under my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong here, but microservices were built to solve a problem when compute was expensive, memory was expensive, storage was expensive. You know, these things were very expensive. Now, God, they're nothing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can throw an app, you could probably throw a Rails app on a T2 medium or something. And I mean, that'll get thousands of people a day.
Yeah, definitely.
Easy. Easy.
It really is pretty economical. And if you're serving thousands of people and you're not like you're not making money off of that, then maybe that's the thing you need to reevaluate rather than, you know, building microservices, you know?
Yeah. Right. And I get it. Like if you are a bootstrap startup that is trying to go world scale, you've got this crazy idea and then you're shooting for investment. You want to show them your books and say, look, there's nothing in these books. Yeah. We are so cheap or so whatever. Everything's run on Lambda, et cetera. But God, the overhead is just awful.
It's massive. Yeah. And yeah. I ran into a startup as a prospect earlier this year. They had raised $1 billion. They were in the like fuel energy space. Like not fuel energy, but like electrical, you know, power charging stations. Yeah. And it was like you had $1 billion, you're servicing at the MVP of your application for your first round is going to be insanely massive, right? Like you're gonna be servicing tens of thousands of locations with, you know, millions of data points a day. Building microservices at that point makes sense. You know, there's a reason for Kubernetes. There's a reason to be thinking about efficiency. Yep. But if you're building a damn API and you're going, hey, I'm going to, you know, use the fastest thing I can, and I'm going to make it as small as I can to run on microservices, then I think you're just thinking about the problem wrong. You're not using the right tool for the job.
Yeah, I was in IoT and I can tell you, dealing with like those oil and gas type deployments and stuff like that, you've got stuff that's communicating in a field or on a mountain somewhere, literally. Like you can't have a lot of traffic flying. So it makes perfect sense to keep it as small as humanly possible. It's sitting on the equivalent of a Raspberry Pi or even smaller. Mm-hmm. So you've got to break that stuff up and it makes sense, especially when managing that many, but yeah, if you're just managing users, especially when you've got Cloudflare Edge, you know, what I can't remember what they call it. Is it Cloudflare Edge, Edge Workers or something like that?
I keep away from Cloudflare.
Okay. Yeah. Well, yeah. You know, all of them have something. You've got CloudFront Edge, you've got all of those types of things.
Yeah.
And, you don't need that stuff, as you just said. I think that's kind of the thing. What do you see as the next iteration of that? I mean, I know people are still barreling towards serverless. Do you think people are going to wake up? Or
my whole thing, I think people are waking up. My whole thing is that serverless is really fantastic. Love it. But also there is the case where you're going to have to jump out to an always on server at some point. And in that case, does it make sense to have your API as a serverless application? Like, does it make sense to break it up? I don't think so. I think, you know, start off with the always running API. And then for the job processor or the, you know, use serverless in the really great examples where it makes sense. And I'm talking about serverless as like Lambda. I think about like Fargate as it's a serverless offering, but it's like always on and it's fantastic and you should use it all the time. But yeah, I don't know. To me, as serverless stands today, we're still always going to have both. And in that world, I think do the thing that's, you know, don't shoehorn yourself into one architecture. Both are valuable. Both have their place.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. So this is, December 18th, 2023, Kelsey Hightower and DHH are actually is DHH in it? DHH, yeah, the founder of Ruby on Rails. They're actually having a Twitter space coming up soon to discuss his migration from the cloud.
Oh, interesting. And Kelsey Hightower, Kelsey Hightower and his like myriad of events. He seems to be involved with random every, you know, things. Yeah.
He's such a great guy. The few times I've had the privilege of just walking by and shaking his hand is about all I could muster.
Yeah.
He's so busy, but the guy is just amazing. Yeah. I will also add that to the show notes once I get that released, because I think everybody would really like to dive into that following this conversation. I think it's going to be really interesting to see what they come up with.
Yeah. The DHH stuff around migrating off cloud is always funny to me. I feel like it's very specific.
Right.
And that's probably a whole other conversation. I don't know if we have time for it, but like I could be happy to jump into my thoughts there. But like,
it's... I mean, if you want to drop them, I've still got beer left.
It's fine. Okay.
We're in the short world. I'm going to break this thing up in like 100 parts and distribute on TikTok and stuff anyway. So
cool.
Drop them.
Yeah. I think the DHH thing around migrating back to on-prem is just, it's like, one, I don't know if the numbers seem to make sense. And I've looked into them a bit. I'm not the expert on them. So maybe I just didn't dig deep enough. But like, was it really cheaper when you like had to retrain people to like, you know, deal with on-prem and managing servers from that perspective? Like, I don't know. It's a whole different mindset that you kind of have to go down. And I think retraining there was something I never saw in his like numbers. And if they didn't have to do that, that seems odd to me. But the big thing is that like, hey, particularly for, you know, most startups to mid-market companies, I think it doesn't make sense, because I think the cloud makes much more sense because it gives you the options of growing into different services that the cloud provides that an on-prem data center is never going to provide. Or if it's going to be prohibitively expensive to invest the time to, you know, use a open source tool that you can run on-prem, but really there's a managed service that AWS provides or Google Cloud provides that would be much faster to use if you were on the cloud. So I think that, hey, if you're iterating on your product at all, don't go on-prem. It just feels like it's that simple. And if you're not iterating on your product, what are you doing? Like, I don't know. They've maybe shoehorned everything into Rails, and there's something really specific there that they're getting right. But like, also, not everybody can do that. They have more involved products. They have more involved infrastructure. And I think that that's like one piece that is not talked about enough in terms of that whole DHH to on-prem migration. Yeah.
I have a few theories on that, but I think one, you're working for, you know, DHH. Like, I have a feeling that he probably attracts some pretty good talent. And that's probably why they didn't need the retraining. And I don't think anybody else is really in that boat. If you're a no-name startup guy or gal or whatever, you're not in that place where you can just say, okay, all the best, come work for me. It's not going to happen.
Yeah.
You're already paying really so much money. Yeah, there's no way that's going to happen.
Nobody's drinking your Kool-Aid. Yeah.
Right. And two, security. Quite frankly, nobody gives a shit about Basecamp and what's in it, except for the people who are using it. Now, I mean, sure, somebody might want to dive in and look into the stuff in your sprint and all this kind of stuff. I mean, there's security concerns everywhere you go.
Yeah.
But we're not talking about Equifax here. We're not talking about, well, look how well they did. we're not talking about, you know,
it's a good one.
Major stuff here. So I think that might be another thing that kind of makes it easier for him to pull this off. And then three, back to your previous points on figure out what you need to solve later. Right now, what you need to do is deploy. You know, that's a summation, obviously, but, you know, back to like kind of the monolith versus serverless versus microservices, all that kind of stuff. I mean, if you're already in the cloud, you're scaling, you're making a ton of money, what makes more sense? Starting on-prem, saving all the money there, and then ending up having to move to the cloud, or that middle ground where things just get real scaly and real nasty really fast? Or is it better to build everything in the cloud, realize it's too expensive, and back out? Do you think a lift and shift back into the data center would make sense when you have a larger staff?
Yeah, I do. But I think it's at that like high end of mid-market where you've got 500 plus employees, 1,000 employees plus, you're not like in the Enterprise territory, but you're not. Yeah, I think it, you know, I'm not saying on-prem doesn't make sense. It totally does. You know, you can get things, you can get compute for dirt cheap, and, you know, save yourself a ton of money if you have really always on workloads that are just cranking. And you're not really, you know, looking to change the way that that software works much. But I think that's a small number of companies. Well, it's not a small number of companies, but it is like, at least in my circles, it's like, it's never what I would recommend. It's just like not a, it doesn't give you the power that you need as a business.
I think the other one's Dropbox. Yeah. Dropbox was the other really big like migration back to on-prem, right?
Can you imagine that not being a smart fiscal decision? Like, you know, their whole thing is storage. Of course. Like even as S3 is the cheapest thing you could possibly get, like object storage in whatever cloud you use, they're going to have so many petabytes of data that they're storing that it doesn't matter how cheap the cloud is for that, for data storage, object storage. It's like going to be so much smarter for them to buy their own hard drives. There's certain business use cases, products that make just direct sense there. But should Dropbox have started on-prem? I still think no. Like, but yeah, it makes a ton of sense to migrate back. Totally.
Yeah. Okay. That makes perfect sense, actually. Yeah. So overall, get out there and get deploying. Stop thinking about what's going to happen in 10 years or 15 years. That's what your investors are for. That's what their money's for. You know, get out there and get it done. Odds are your little app is probably not going to incur a $10,000 bill from AWS until you are making enough money to pay it. My understanding of what I've seen so far anyway.
Good, succinct way of saying it. I like that.
Nice. I love it.
Good stuff. Okay. Yeah. It's been fun, man.
Yeah, absolutely. Cheers, Matt. Thanks again. And how should our users find you?
You can get in contact with me at matt@masterpoint.io. And just check out our website at masterpoint.io. That's masterpoint as in master, POINT.io.
All right, guys. Thanks again for listening. Again, we got Matt Gowie here. It's been an awesome show. I will release all of the notes and blogs and things like that as soon as I release the episode. So anyway, cheers and thanks again.